Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Glasses Manifesto.
Maybe I had an unconscious death wish. You know, the doctor says that because I wanted to go to Vietnam. This is probably true, but there were more too. I felt very patriotic. I was pretty sort of right wing, you know, and I wanted to go into Vietnam to fight for the country. So I was always, you know, uphold the image as a good, loyal citizen. So I could say I was always kind of not outright evil.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 5. Goodbye, sweetheart. Hello, Vietnam. Act 1. Sort of like a loner.
As David Berkowitz enters his high school years, he is traumatized, shattered by the death of his mother, feeling even more guilt that he somehow was a cause of that, at least a source that complicated the illness she had that killed her.
When David Berkowitz's adoptive mother, Pearl, died in 1967 during David's freshman year of high school, two important things happened. The first was that he considered himself directly responsible. Pearl had died of cancer, which can be exacerbated by stress, and he had tormented her day and night. He had also wished her dead the day she left and never came back, all of which added up in his 14-year-old mind to the fact that he had in some way caused her death, and that made him a murderer. And it wasn't the first time. At the tender age of 5, his adoptive parents, Nat and Pearl, in an effort to be open, honest, and modern in the treatment of their child, had told him of his adoption, explaining that his adoptive mother had died tragically during his birth, which is what they had been instructed to tell him by the adoption agency. And that, to him, meant that he had done her in as well. And so, at 14 years old, a newly minted teenager, David Berkowitz considered himself to be the indirect murderer of not just one, but two women. The second was that with Pearl gone, David was left alone with his father, Nat. The two had never been close, and with Nat struggling to keep his little neighborhood hardware store afloat, David was left without the crucially needed oversight Pearl had provided, especially as it related to school. Pearl had forced him to do his homework, arranged special meetings with his teachers, and just kept an eye on him in general, doing everything she possibly could to make sure David was as successful in his studies as he absolutely could be. And so, with Pearl gone and Nat at work, struggling to make ends meet, David Berkowitz began to disengage from school entirely.
Were you excessively truly?
Yeah. I know if I could have put my mind into school that I could have really done good, you know, but I didn't.
He basically quit going.
Did you ever fail any grades in high school?
Yeah. I used to be truant a lot, so I failed just about everything in the 10th grade.
In fact, during David's 10th grade year at Christopher Columbus High School, the school that Pearl had gone out of her way to enroll him in, he was absent 36 days, an amount the school deemed excessive. Quote, I figured the big people at the Board of Education didn't give a shit about the students. If the big people and the teachers didn't care, why should I? End quote. David was spinning out, and it was all unbeknownst to Nat.
Do you think your mother's death had something to do with that sudden upsurge?
Yeah.
When you say foresight, do you mean D average, C average?
D average, I see. But the teachers always said that I could have done good work if I tried. Because sometimes I do real good work. But the problem is I'd be disruptive and fighting and things.
Did you ever fail?
Oh, yeah.
Quote, "When I was truant from school, I either took long walks or stayed home watching television, or merely spending aimless hours. Then at 3:30, I'd telephone my father at his store that I just came home from school, even though I never went," end quote. David Berkowitz was flunking out of high school, and he was doing it on purpose.
I deliberately chose to rebel against school, you know, chose to rebel against parental authority, and, you know, did malicious mischief constantly, you know, break things, set a fire in a lot, or break windows, that type of thing. In other words, I had like an abundance of energy or something, you see, but instead of gearing it towards something positive, you know, like doing schoolwork or something, or participating in a Boy Scout program, you do something negative, you know. And not only that, but you do it alone.
Nat was gone and Pearl was dead. And since David had never been very good at making connections with others anyway, that didn't leave a lot of options. Jack asked David if there was anyone he could have talked to.
No. Everyone was immature back then. You know, couldn't get into any deep discussions about anything.
What about guidance counselors?
They were phonies. They did nothing. There's one guidance counselor for like 200 students, you know. Every student's got a problem. They never accomplish anything. All the guidance counselors do is guide you what programs to take, whether you want to take the academic or, you know, if you want to go into a certain college, they'll give you the information how to do it or something. And that was it. They don't help with personal problems.
In his own sneaky way, David Berkowitz was reaching out via mischief and mayhem, hoping someone would engage with him as Pearl had done and never gave up doing until she died. But now Pearl was gone, and he needed someone to step in and take her place.
And he was really seeking guidance through that whole thing. I mean, a lot of what he was doing was saying, somebody find me, somebody report me for setting this fire. And he was always such an average-looking, active, and non-threatening, visually kind of person that whenever something really bad did happen, that they would want to find out who it was, he was the last person they would look for.
And so, with no alarm pulled, with no finger pointed, innocent-looking, cherubic-faced David Berkowitz was not only flunking out of high school, he was drifting away from society in general.
It wasn't until in my teenage years that I began to drift apart and become sort of like a loner. But when I was a kid, I used to run with all the other guys. We used to go to the other block and fight the other guys, you know. Nothing serious. And just rumbling on the rolling around on the floor, you know.
Fighting with the neighborhood kids of his youth, apparently the high water mark of his community involvement, David wasn't part of any group anymore, not even in the loosest of terms. He was out on his own, wrecking havoc. Quote, "When I broke windows and car antennas, I did it alone. When I overturned a gallon can of white paint in the stairwell, I did it alone. This act caused a lot of damage and the super raised hell, but he never knew it was me. There was no motive, but I had a compulsion to do this and mess up the hallway, and this act was one of a multitude that I did throughout my life without any rhyme or reason."
The anger he was born with is like a chemical fire of some kind that just continues to spread. He never is able to establish a friendship there. There's never a subject that he becomes interested in. There's nothing except this emptiness inside that he nurtures through solitude and antisocial actions right through his teenage years and young adulthood.
With a predilection towards arson, theft, and malicious damage of every kind and sort he could manage, David Berkowitz was the quintessential angry young man, with one notable exception.
What kind of things did you enjoy doing after school, other than malicious mischief?
I played a lot of sports, mostly softball.
Yep, you heard that right. turns out David Berkowitz was really good at sports. Quote, I loved sports, all types, baseball, softball, punchball, slug, football, paddleball, handball, and tennis. End quote. In fact, one of the neighborhood dads recalled that David was especially good at baseball, saying, quote, David was always the winner. He taught my son about defeat. I think if they played 600 games in a season, David won 600. End quote. But David's physical acuity wasn't all this neighborhood dad remembered. He also remembered that the relationship between David and Nat was especially distant. So he attempted, at least for a time, to take up the slack by taking David along to events he was taking his own son to. Once, he even took the boys to a football game at Shea Stadium and introduced them to the manager of the San Francisco Giants. The man also encouraged David to try out for the Little League team, but David declined because David, the man felt, was afraid of being a failure in front of other people. But when he did eventually join, he said of David's performance, quote, he was the best one on the team, end quote. David would say himself years later, quote, sports was my life during those childhood and teenage days. School meant nothing to me, end quote. And it makes sense in a way. David was a big kid who was bad at communicating with others. He was physical, not verbal, and sports made sense to him. It was something he could do, something he was good at. But somehow, despite most sports being a group activity and a great way to make friends to boot, the way David did it left him very much alone and in his preferred state of isolation.
High school, that whole era, is about belonging. It's about cliques and groups and clubs, and you're a jet or you're a shark or you're something. And he was nothing. He wasn't part of any of that. He had nothing and no one, and he didn't go out of his way to ingratiate himself. Like most of us, you know, take the knocks and the humiliation and get knocked down and beat up. But we're part of it. Not him. He went somewhere else and started another fire or vandalized somebody's car or anything malicious he could do that was going to upset somebody, and it didn't matter who, but never went through the rites of passage that most of us go through and survive in order to become functioning adults at whatever level.
Did you try to find a girlfriend, a companion? Did you try to find male friends that you could sit around? Bullshit.
Well, I made a half-hearted attempt, you know. Mm-hmm. Every time something wasn't too successful, you know, I take it as a personal affront, and it would build up my anger, you know.
Were more attempts unsuccessful than successful?
Right. That's definitely, because if they would have been successful, I probably would have been here now, you see. The only reason I became angry and hostile was because I wasn't successful, and it built up, you know.
And to David, of course, he felt like he was the only one who wasn't figuring things out. His cousins on his father's side were tall, good-looking, popular with the ladies, and got great grades. David was chubby, had bad acne, and couldn't get a girlfriend to save his life. But then, as David looked at it, he wasn't related to them anyway. He was adopted. Act 2, Mr. Control. In keeping with his lifelong tradition to never really get along that well with anyone, it probably won't surprise you to hear that David Berkowitz's relationship with women was rocky from the get. Something he was tempted to blame on the long commute from his home on Stratford Avenue in the South Bronx to Columbus High School in the North Bronx. Quote, my social life at Soundview was screwed up by the long, lousy trip to high school. I didn't have a date. I met some girls. I wanted to. They were shy. End quote. Still, David Berkowitz was starting to get interested in the opposite sex. Quote, I'd say I was 15 when I got, you know, interested in girls. In the beginning, at Co-op City, I had friends. There were maybe 500 young people there, and I went out with a couple girls. They came from neighborhoods that were more sheltered than Soundview.
Dates and things like that in high school, did you go out fairly regularly on the weekends with somebody?
I had a lot of girlfriends, but they were very shallow relationships, you know. Never lasted long.
David Berkowitz was making an attempt to connect with the opposite sex in a way that he felt was expected of him. And it sounds like, at least in the beginning, there were a few takers. Quote, We were all clumsy together. We didn't know how to do much except kiss. If you wanted to make out, you just walked to the dark area, end quote. And with that, David, at least at first, was caught up in the great and magical sexual awakening of adolescence right along with his peer group. But I get the sense that quickly and soon he was left behind. Quote, after a while at Co-op City, there wasn't one girl that was a virgin. That whole group, everyone got older, 18, 19, end quote. No one was a virgin, that is, except for David. He had yet to cross that elusive and perceived line that supposedly delineates childhood from adulthood. And due to that, stood on the banks alone, the rest of his classmates safely on the other side. And it wasn't just sex that divided him from the others. It was the changing of the times. It was, after all, the late 1960s. Quote, so much freedom there. Drugs finally came in. You know, pot and everything. I was still pretty straight, but I wouldn't smoke pot or anything. Everyone sort of became sort of like hippies. I still wanted the girls, but I didn't want the other stuff, the drugs or anything. End quote. But despite his continuing to be at odds with everyone and everything around him, there was one girl that stood out to David. There always is. Her name was Iris Gearhart.
Did you have a special thing for this Iris Gearhart? Yeah,
but not anymore. I don't know, you know. I was in love with her, yeah, at the time.
You were what, 17 or so?
Right.
The only person he remembered from high school, the woman that he sort of had a romantic relationship with but never consummated, they were never sexually involved.
Here's what Iris had to say about it, read here by our series producer, Allison Baker. Quote,
I confess I liked him a lot, but then I was only 18. It's hard to believe, but Dave was a guy who would do anything for you. We all hung around a local community club. As for sex, Dave and I just kissed each other on the lips in a building behind Co-op City. Nothing more. We just kissed on the lips.
He had a real or probably mostly imagined romantic connection with her. A high school classmate, as far as we know, the only one to whom he was attracted as a friend or potential romantic partner.
Real or imagined, one thing is for certain. The relationship between Iris and David did not turn out the way David had hoped.
He did talk about one time being disappointed when he saw her with another boy.
Iris Gearhart had been unfaithful, or at least that's the way David saw it.
I was going with this girl, Iris Gearhart. I lived in Co-op City in the housing development. And the day before, I was making out with her. Then my friend told me that he saw her in the park. This is at the other end, this playground area, making out with this guy, Gary or something. And after that, we broke up. She went with him. And I was definitely, I felt shitty, really.
Did you feel like hurting her, hurting him?
Yeah, but you see, at that time, I was always Mr., you know, control. I never, like, you know, think of, like, I thought of it, but I never did it. But I see I was wrong in a sense that I never chewed her out or something or yelled at her or threw that guy on the ground.
David Berkowitz had considered hurting Iris and Gary, hurting them for hurting him. Regardless of whether there was ever an actual relationship between them, he had cared for Iris, and he had been hurt, and in a moment of teenage pain, had considered getting even.
I would take that as rejection, which is worse than punishment. You know, I would get punished because I deserve it. Like, if she dies a sudden death, I'd figure, well, this is the sense of justice in the world, you know, God watching constantly, waiting for to get even. That I could accept, because I had that coming. But something like this, when you're madly in love with the girl and you think everything's going fine and then you find out she's having an affair or something behind your back, there's not too many men that take that too lightly.
You wouldn't have just said, oh, well, so it goes.
No.
Would you have maybe killed her?
I don't know, Jack.
Considered it, and thankfully had not gone through with it. Now, if David had gone on from here to play shortstop for the New York Yankees, taken over his father's hardware store, got married and had a family, or even had just not gone on to murder innocent people, then no harm, no foul, right? But that isn't what happened. David did become a murderer, and in light of those future events, it feels significant. David Berkowitz had contemplated his first violent act against a woman.
This was when you were in high school, then?
Yeah. See, a normal thing to do, I wish I had done it, was to go over to that guy and punch him in the nose. I didn't. And that's where I was wrong, in a sense, because I just kept it bottled in. And it was one of my trump cards, you know, to use for society. You understand what I'm saying? Like, okay, I'm going to start hurting people in society everywhere.
Iris Gearhart, through no fault of her own, became one of what David referred to as his quote-unquote trump cards. Cards he would pull out and use at a later date to justify hateful and violent acts against young women and men.
This is why I pulled all these trump cards. You follow me? And that's one of the reasons. But if I had, instead of just holding the anger in, or holding the frustration in, I should have just released it right there. And says, look, I don't like what you're doing, you know, because my girlfriend was at fault, too. I found out later she played around a lot on a lot of guys. She wasn't that sweet and innocent. I should have yelled at her good or something and smacked this guy in the head. They both had it coming, you know. That would be a normal thing to do rather than just hold it in and shrug it off, because I still didn't forgive them, you understand? They might have thought that because I just shrugged it off and just went on my way.
But he didn't forgive them. Quite the opposite. He shoved the feelings down below the surface, forcing them to the bottom of his soul. And once they were down there, he pushed them down even farther, to a place so cold and remote it was guaranteed they would fester. A place where they would be alone like he was. A place where they could one day rise up and apply to all women, all people, everywhere.
I wonder why it was easier to see these women as objects than it was to see old people or disgusting, loudmouthed businessmen.
I guess I had been more hurt by these people at the time.
During the crimes, did you ever stand there pulling the trigger saying, this one's for you, mother, or this one's for you, Iris, or...
Not really, you know, but maybe the thought was there.
But that would all come out a bit later. For now, it was just David and it was just Iris, alone in Co-op City, where his experiences with her would color all his interactions with the rest of the girls in the neighborhood. Quote, girls in Co-op City didn't find me attractive. I began to hate girls and I wanted to join the army, end quote.
Any relationship he ever had with anyone other than his adoptive mother, Pearl, was very superficial. Today, you would label him an incel.
Quote, I never liked to kiss. In those days, you had to be masculine, a strong guy like James Dean. I kept away from girls because to stay with them was sissy stuff. I remember my mom when she kissed me, but it wasn't affectionately. My grandmother, Helen, also wanted to kiss me, but I didn't want to. As to father, I wouldn't let him kiss me. I always resented him quite a lot because he had my mother. I resented my father because he had my mother, end quote. As David ponders his varied experiences with the physical touch commonly known as kissing, the thing that jumps out is, of course, the way in which David conflates the kissing of relatives with the kissing of young women he was interested in, almost as if he saw no distinction between the two general categories.
David Berkowitz was as close as you might find to a definition of an asexual male. He knew somehow that society expected him to be sexually active with women, but he didn't know how, so he was in all likelihood a virgin when he joined the army.
In fact, it seemed that not only was Berkowitz a virgin when he joined the army, but that his virginity had played at least, maybe even not a very minor role in his decision to enlist in the first place, saying later, quote, I joined the army in order to lose my virginity, end quote. Frustrated, confused, and armed with the death wish he had had since birth, David Berkowitz enlisted in the U.S. Army, where he'd be given a gun and sent to a foreign country. What could possibly go wrong?
When you were in the Army, I guess they taught you to use guns and
yeah.
that sort of thing. Did you enjoy that combat training?
Yes, I did. I signed up for infantry, even before I had any real interest in guns, because I never even handled a real gun until I got into the Army. My father never owned any. He was against guns.
Can you in any way say that military training and handling a firearm gave you confidence to start stockpiling the weapons?
Well, I would make a lot of American Legion guys angry in the area, you know. But, well, it might be a carryover, you know. I'd say yes.
This would have been probably the last opportunity to arrest that darkness and chaos and anger and irrational kind of emotional pit that he was born with. And it didn't happen because the one person who had cared and who had probably recognized it, she was dead. She was out of the picture. And there's no way that Nat was going to see this or have the time or resources to deal with it if he did.
Joining the Army was the great and wonderful ripcord David Berkowitz planned to pull on his entire high school career. But you have to graduate, or at least get a GED, to enlist in the military. And David was actively flunking out. He was well on his way to, that is, when Nat finally got wise, went down to the school, found out what was going on, and made arrangements for David to make up the classes he had failed in summer school. And so, in the spring of 1971, David Berkowitz graduated with an 83.3 GPA, enabling him to join the U.S. Army just a few weeks after his 18th birthday on June 23rd, 1971. Act 3, Run Through the Jungle. All throughout David Berkowitz's high school years, the war in Southeast Asia, known officially as the quote-unquote Vietnam conflict, had been increasing in chaos and violence since the U.S. officially joined the war in 1965, the result of which had been steadily increasing public resistance back at home, and by 71, the war was almost unilaterally unpopular, especially amongst young men who were the primary targets of the draft. While there were, of course, still dressed-down youth supporting the war in the early 70s, by and large, the quote-unquote hippie culture, popularized by music and fashion in the late 60s, had reached every corner of the nation and was considered the fare of the day for young people looking to make a mark. But this was a wave that David did not ride. David was pro-war. He was a patriot. He cut his hair short, tucked his shirt into his trousers, and saluted the flag. Publicly and visibly, all while being a private and prolific arsonist by any stretch of the imagination. Not that anyone had even the slightest inkling of what he was up to. So outwardly, as most American teenagers were tripping off to class barefoot and letting their hair grow long, David went another way.
Did you read a lot or follow with a lot of interest stories about the atrocities in Vietnam?
Not that much, because I was as a teenager, I didn't read too much of the newspapers and things. And Vietnam was just starting to go, but I wanted to go to Vietnam. I read enough, I guess, about it, you know, because I wanted to go into the Army to fight in Vietnam.
While many of his male peers were figuring out ways to avoid the draft, David was trying to figure out how to get in. He wanted to go to Vietnam, and he joined up the first chance he got.
You were 18 when you joined the Army.
Right.
And that was in
1971. June of 71.
You must have just turned 18. Your birthday's June 1st?
Mm-hmm. I just turned 18 the day before I joined the Army. I graduated high school. I went right in. But I had prepared. It wasn't an impulse thing. I had been planning on going into the Army for about 8 months. I had taken all the tests and, you know, checked up all the brochures and everything, and made about 15 trips or so to the Army recruiter's office to talk and things, and then finally I had made this decision, so it wasn't an impulse thing to join the Army. I made up my mind, that's what I wanted to do.
And he had multiple reasons for doing so. His lifelong death wish, combined with his increasing troubles with women, no doubt enough to make pulling the ripcord seem like an appealing option, It wasn't the only thing that may have encouraged him to sign up for what could have possibly been a one-way ticket out of the Bronx. Just a few months before, Nat had remarried. And let's just say, not too surprisingly, that David did not react well. Nat was disappointed with his son's behavior, saying later, quote, "David used to go into his room and play records all day long, never came out to talk," end quote. As far as David was concerned, Nat was moving on without him, and David was being left behind. And in some ways, that was true. Whereas David had been central to the dynamic between Nat and Pearl, that could not be said of Nat's new relationship. David had always had a tenuous relationship with Nat, and now Nat was investing time and energy in a new relationship that had nothing to do with him. A relationship that I can only imagine functioned better than the one he had with David. And let's not forget, David Berkowitz had a tenuous relationship with all people, women most of all, and so it wasn't shocking that Nat's new wife was no exception. Quote, "She meant well, Dad was happy, and that's all that mattered. I always told people that she was generous to me, but we didn't get along. She had a different set of rules. She didn't give me any freedom as my dad used to. I never got into trouble. I used to come up at 11:30 at night. She made a comment to Dad on things I did. She had other children, like married with kids of their own already. When they came, I'd say hello, nothing else," end quote. Nat remarried and moving on with his life, David enlisted in the military to go fight, possibly die, in Vietnam. But Nat, being David's father, thought a smarter move would be for his son to go to college, and he urged him to reconsider. But David wouldn't have it, and was dead set on going, saying, quote, "I wanted some adventure. I wanted experience of life. Something different, you know? I had no idea what to do in college, what to major in. I wanted to serve the country and get an education through the Army," end quote. And that's what he did. David Berkowitz enlisted in the U.S. Army on June 23, 1971 at the Army Induction Center on Whitehall Street, Manhattan, just 20 days after his 18th birthday. The following month, he passed his physical and psychological evaluation tests that would make him an official member. David was in the Army now. As military service had done for so many people, it provided David with an immediate and complete sense of purpose and identity, something he sorely lacked. And perhaps more importantly, it gave him a way out of his father's house. And at the same time, it put him just a little bit closer to his dreams of combat in the jungles of Southeast Asia.
Why did you feel like you wanted to go to Vietnam?
Well, I was very patriotic and had a death wish. You know, self-destructive thing. I can't explain it to
you. You said you wanted to go to Vietnam. You didn't have any sort of bloodlust at that point that made you want to go to Vietnam?
Perhaps subconsciously, but I wasn't aware of it.
There wasn't any sort of suicidal...
Oh, yes, definitely, yeah. Well, that was what it was, you know. I'd always turned in my angers and frustrations at that time into myself. In time, however, it reversed itself, and it went outward, you see.
He was angry, he was alone, he was a patriot, and he wanted to die. As with most things in his life, his reasons were many and conflicted. But it wouldn't be David Berkowitz without dedicating heart and mind to cross purposes, and so he threw one last wrench into the works before shipping off to war. Because, even though he was now primarily concerned with dying a hero's death while serving his country in Vietnam, he did still harbor the desire to die battling the blaze back in the Bronx, a desire he had held since Pearl's death. So which would it be? He was, he thought, well on his way to one, so he might as well take one last stab at the other. To this end, David and some other kids from Co-op City formed a volunteer fire department. Quote, "I wanted to help people. A lot of the kids were doing absolutely nothing. They just passed time in local hangouts. They were high all the time. I wanted to help people. Be important," end quote.
I always used to try to help people. I know. And like, I was an auxiliary policeman, auxiliary fireman, always, you know, involved in, like, okay, I was only 18, 19 years old at the time, but I was still, even then, beginning to be involved in civic affairs or helping the community.
And so, David Berkowitz, a secret and accomplished arsonist, became, for a short time, a volunteer fireman. Being a good guy, or at least appearing that way, was important to him. He used that good guy image to cover up whatever evil intentions he was busy feeding under the table. And since those were the things he didn't want people to see, they needed to be hidden. And it was his want to search out something he felt was of an equal and opposite value to cover them up with. If he held those things in one hand, he held that hand behind his back, while out in front of himself, with an outstretched arm, he presented the other. He wanted to go to Vietnam because he wanted to die, but that little piece of information would not be a part of his official statement.
I joined the country out of a lot of patriotic reasons, but there were other reasons too, you know, more than one. Maybe I had an unconscious death wish. You know, the doctor says that because I wanted to go to Vietnam. But this is probably true, but there were more too. I felt very patriotic. I was very sort of right wing, you know. And I wanted to go into Vietnam to fight for the country. So I was always, you know, uphold the image as a good, loyal citizen. So I could say I was always kind of not outright evil, you know, just trying to be helpful to either the community or people in general or the country.
With all these bundled up and conflicting reasons, good guy David Berkowitz, a romantically challenged loner type with a death wish, joins the war effort in June of 1971.
He said at one point that I wanted to be a movie action soldier. He wanted to maybe go out in a blaze of glory. He knew he had this death wish and death fascination. That was a big part of going into the Army.
But while his induction into the Army got him closer to his death wish fantasy, it did also have the nice little added ancillary benefit of further separating him from the people he went to school with, and not just geographically. David's attraction to patriotism was yet another way to reject his peer group, protect his isolation, and nurture his anger, which had become his main passion in life. He would later describe his classmates as, quote, kids who were hippies or into drugs. I was gung-ho, almost straight. I sort of lived like behind the times. I wanted to see some action, prove something to myself. It was rebellion then against parents, country and stuff. Kids were hippies and into drugs. I guess then I was very patriotic. Nobody else except a couple people were, end quote. And so even better, if he could get out of Co-op City and into the blood-filled jungles of Southeast Asia without issue, it would also serve not just as a socially accepted outlet for his rage, but would also give him the appearance of a heroic soldier gone to war to fight for his country, all while supplying him with a much-needed sense of superiority. It was the perfect 1-2 punch he was looking for, and he was well on his way to attaining it.
He trained for the infantry and wanted to fight in Vietnam. He says that was out of a sense of patriotism, but he may have simply wanted to go where violence was happening and he could witness and perhaps commit homicide firsthand, perhaps even legally, as a soldier.
He wanted to go and fight in Vietnam, and he wanted to die. Not only for the darkness he had felt inside himself from childhood, but also for the deaths of both his biological and adoptive mothers, which he had pinned on himself long ago. And yeah, as Jack says, maybe he had hoped he'd score some violence for free and legally as an American soldier in Vietnam. But as it turns out, that wasn't in the cards.
He volunteered to go to Vietnam, but the unit he was with, the infantry unit, was diverted to Korea because the war was winding down.
By the time David Berkowitz graduated from high school in 1971, the war that had accomplished unbelievable carnage in the middle to late 1960s had reached its apex early in 1968, when the Tet Offensive, a reversal of the customary Tet ceasefire, which was historically held in honor of the Vietnamese Lunar New Year, was overturned by the Viet Cong, catching American forces largely unaware. The very next month, Walter Cronkite called the war, quote-unquote, unwinnable in a national broadcast. And although the war did not officially end until the spring of 1975, many considered 1968 to be the height of the war that found itself in a state of decline over the following years. The draft continued and troops were still being sent to the tiny Asian country, but not nearly as many as had been just a few years before. And so David Berkowitz, unlucky in life, found himself being sent not to the boiling, burning fire pit of violence he craved in Vietnam, but to a quiet outpost in South Korea, where the war there had been over for years.
He was sent instead to South Korea, where has been an uneasy truce and peace and large numbers of American troops stationed since the Korean War, which sustain a local population of prostitutes and bars and drug pushers.
Next time on Killer Tape, David starts interacting with women sexually while internally dealing with his desire to do them harm.
When you were in the Army, I guess they taught you to use guns and that sort of thing. Did you enjoy that combat training?
Yes, I did. I signed up for infantry even before I had any real interest in guns, because I never even handled a real gun until I got into the Army. My father never owned any. He was against guns.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.